Today, we are undertaking a really critical deep dive. We're looking at a single comprehensive piece of analysis. And this paper argues that the international tension involving Venezuela right now, it's far more than just a regional conflict.
Right, it's not a security spat.
No. According to this analysis, it's a profound, immediate stress test of the entire global rules-based order. I mean, the crisis is genuinely bigger than its headlines suggest, and the stakes, well, they seem to apply to every state on the planet.
And that's really the mission Dr. Bachar-Sahili sets out for us in his white paper, When Power Outruns Law. We're basically being asked to answer a fundamental question. Is international law still operating as an active, effective constraint on power?
Or has it just become a tool?
Or has it devolved into a political tool, something you just use to justify unilateral actions after you've already taken them?
The vantage point here is so important. Dr. Sahili is a physician, a systems thinker from the Caribbean, and that gives this paper a really unique focus. He doesn't see international law as some dusty academic subject. He calls it protective infrastructure.
And if that infrastructure fails,
Then vulnerable people suffer the immediate systemic consequences.
and that small state perspective, the one that feels the systemic shockwaves first, that's why this analysis is so powerful. It's not theoretical for them.
Right.
And just as a fascinating side note, the paper itself was co-authored with research and drafting support from ChatGPT 5.2.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an interesting detail. It really highlights how these advanced synthesis tools are now being brought to bear on, these really complex geopolitical realities.
Okay, let's unpack this right away. If we strip away the immediate politics, what is the core, really unsettling question this whole situation forces every government to confront?
I think the core question is about precedent. It's about the silent erosion of norms. The paper asks if the gradual normalization of exceptions, actions that just bypass collective authorization, is quietly dismantling the basic order that protects all states,
Especially the smaller ones.
especially the smaller, more vulnerable ones. The argument is that the rules don't often collapse in some big dramatic crisis. They fail slowly, by drift, as these exceptions just become routine.
So before we get into that systemic breakdown, we really need to establish the clear factual baseline that's in the source. And again, the paper is trying to analyze the system's reaction, not, assign guilt in the underlying conflict. So what's its summary of the coercive actions that were taken?
The summary is pretty concise. A powerful external state used overt coercive measures against Venezuela. These actions were publicly justified by a mix of severe criminal allegations, urgent national security claims, and assertions of immediate necessity.
And the most high-profile results.
The forcible removal of senior political figures, and then the assertion of jurisdiction over them by a foreign domestic court. So well outside the prosecuting state's own borders.
And when the paper looks at the method used here, what stands out as, legally problematic from an international perspective?
Well, what's undeniably clear is that force was used extraterritorially. This wasn't a border defense operation.
Right.
And crucially, the actions were taken without authorization from the UN Security Council.
Which is the whole mechanism designed for the collective use of force.
Exactly. Instead, the justification came mainly from domestic legal instruments, from the executive authority of the powerful state involved. And this completely bypassed the global mechanism. And it immediately destabilized the region. It caused airspace uncertainty, maritime risks, a deep diplomatic rupture.
This really highlights that conflict of logics the paper describes. You've got three powerful narratives all colliding, and the key is that each one seems, internally logical from its own perspective.
Exactly. First, you have the law enforcement narrative, and it's compelling. It argues that transnational crimes, like drug trafficking, are just too pervasive.
And borders shouldn't shield wrongdoing.
Right. If a state is shielding criminals, then borders become an obstacle to justice, and extraordinary measures become necessary.
And that logic plays directly into the second narrative, the national security narrative.
It does, which argues that these aren't just traditional criminal operations, they're hybrid threats, where crime networks and state actors merge.
So it's an urgent danger.
An urgent danger that means you have to skip the slow diplomatic procedures. In this view, delay is danger. Urgency has to override process.
But the paper's main concern seems to lie with that third narrative, the sovereignty and international law narrative.
That's where the focus is. That narrative insists that however serious the claims are, they do not automatically dissolve the legal limits on unilateral force. It says executive claims about urgency can't just replace the need for collective authorization, because if you do that, you destroy the very foundation of sovereign equality that protects every single state.
What's fascinating here is the paper's focus on what it calls the critical failure point, independent verification.
That's the weak link. When the facts are incomplete and the collective multilateral mechanisms for actually verifying them are bypassed, the powerful state sets a precedent without proof.
Precedent without proof. I like that phrasing.
Yeah. And once force or coercion is normalized based on one state's unilateral claim, a claim that isn't subjected to any shared international scrutiny, it just makes every future coercive action easier to justify and exponentially harder to contain.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. The paper says the single most dangerous confusion in this whole crisis is blurring the line between criminal accountability and the use of force. Why are those two things so fundamentally different?
Well, they exist in totally separate legal spheres for a very good reason. Think of criminal accountability as a slow, deliberate system. Its whole goal is to assign responsibility to individuals.
Right, through a process.
Through meticulous mechanisms. Investigation, evidence, due process, extradition, a fair trial. Its power comes entirely from its legitimacy and its reliance on international cooperation.
It's the rule of law focusing narrowly on the individual, prioritizing accuracy over speed.
Exactly. Now, contrast that with the use of force. This is governed by the international rules of peace and security. It is meant to be absolutely exceptional. It's tightly constrained by the UN Charter, permissible only in clear self-defense or with collective international authorization.
And its logic is immediacy.
It's immediacy and necessity, but crucially, its use collectivizes risk. It doesn't just target one person. It immediately affects entire regions, civilian populations, neighboring states.
So if we just let these two systems blend, what are the practical systemic dangers the paper warns against?
Well, it identifies three huge risks. First, it dramatically lowers the threshold for force.
How so?
If criminal suspicion, which let's be honest, is far easier for a powerful state to generate than getting Security Council approval, if that becomes enough justification for cross-border coercion, well, the decision to use force moves from a shared, highly restricted judgment to simple prosecutorial discretion in one country.
So you're using the language of the courtroom to bypass the constraints of the battlefield.
Precisely. The second risk is that it removes reciprocity. In this scenario, one state acts as investigator, prosecutor, judge, and enforcer beyond its borders, unilaterally.
Which establishes a norm that leaves every other state vulnerable.
Of course. Because they have no comparable legitimate authority to act in return. It just destroys the whole idea of sovereign equality.
And the third risk, which feels the most insidious, is the corrosion of trust.
Yeah. If law enforcement operations repeatedly look, sound, and feel like military intervention or economic warfare, the crucial ability to distinguish between protection and outright domination just disappears.
And once that line is gone?
Once that line is erased, states stop trusting the system. They revert to prioritizing their own immediate security over any kind of external cooperation.
So the paper makes a pretty compelling case that insisting on this separation isn't about protecting alleged criminals.
Not at all.
It's a firewall against the much greater danger. The normalization of international coercion justified by mere accusation.
It's protecting the very mechanism that keeps international relations from just devolving into a permanent state of selective enforcement. And when that distinction collapses, accountability becomes highly selective.
And selective law is?
It's functionally power dressed up as principle.
Let's turn to the protective infrastructure itself then, the international legal architecture that's supposed to prevent this. The UN Charter, what was the simple post World War II bargain it established?
The deal was, revolutionary in its simplicity. The default mode of international relations would no longer involve force. Powerful states agreed to restrain themselves in principle and submit to rules that apply to everyone.
So sovereignty means borders matter.
Borders are inviolable, and unilateral force is strictly prohibited, except in two very narrow cases: self-defense against an armed attack, or explicit collective authorization.
So the Charter's value is enforcing restraint.
Forcing restraint and demanding justification that others can actually scrutinize. It's designed to buy time.
And a key element the paper talks about, one that's often dismissed, is head of state immunity. Why does the paper argue this rule is so vital, regardless of the individuals involved?
Because it's a procedural rule, not a moral one. It is not a shield for ultimate impunity.
Right.
The paper points out that leaders can and should be prosecuted once they leave office, or by legitimate international tribunals with collective backing. But immunity is a necessary mechanism to stop international relations from collapsing into a, paralyzing cycle of competing arrest warrants and political coercion.
So if I'm hearing you right, the rule isn't protecting the individual's freedom. It's protecting the collective ability of diplomats and heads of state to just do their jobs.
To engage in negotiation in crisis management without the constant fear of being arrested by a foreign entity on foreign soil.
It preserves the system itself.
Precisely. If any powerful state can unilaterally decide to dismiss a head of state's immunity using their own domestic court system, they weaken the protection that rule offers to all states.
And the tension between domestic and international law, that's another source of strain here.
Absolutely. They operate in parallel, and the paper clarifies that an action can be entirely legal under a domestic court's ruling, say an asset seizure, but at the same time be destabilizing and internationally concerning.
Because it violates the prohibition on using force across borders.
Exactly. The danger is when that domestic legality is used as the only argument to just dismiss all international concerns about sovereignty and coercion.
It sounds like this entire legal architecture is cracking because it wasn't designed for a world where threats move faster than diplomacy.
That's the core tension. The architecture is under strain because of extreme power asymmetry. Some states feel they can act first and explain later because the cost of bypassing the system is lower for them than waiting. As threats get more diffuse and urgent, the temptation to substitute unilateral action for that slow process, it just gets stronger. That's why the system fails by drift.
This slow drift brings us to the concept of precedent, which the paper argues matters more than the immediate crisis. So how does international law actually change through, behavior and silence?
Well, international law doesn't have a parliament that votes on new legislation. It evolves through repeated patterns of behavior and, this is critical, through shared belief.
Oh, okay.
So when unilateral actions that stretch or bypass existing rules are taken, and those actions are met with a muted or silent international response, that silence gets absorbed into the system as acquiescence.
So silence is interpreted as tacit legal approval.
Exactly. That silent normalization allows the extraordinary to become routine. Powerful states test the limits and treat rules as flexible. Weaker states experience this as extreme exposure.
And they stay quiet out of caution or dependence.
Right. But the precedent is set. And it will endure. It will be invoked by others, maybe in far less compelling circumstances, because the legal argument has already been written into the historical record.
The paper frames the Caribbean, the author's home region, as the canary in the system. What makes small states the early indicators of this kind of systemic stress?
They just lack the strategic depth, the military reach, and the economic resilience of larger powers. Mm. For them, disruption isn't a theory.
Right.
When maritime uncertainty rises or airspace is destabilized or supply chains are disrupted, it's an immediate existential threat to their economy, to their tourism, to their energy access.
They feel the collateral damage instantly.
They are the first to feel that collective risk. So their call for process, for verification, for restraint, it's not some timid idealism. It is survival wisdom.
And speaking of casualties, let's look at the human stakes. What the paper calls the quiet casualties, when law gives way to force.
The paper really emphasizes that civilian risk is often felt far from any overt battlefield. It travels through essential systems.
So supply chains, healthcare.
Disruptions to supply chains, access to critical healthcare, reliable energy. These cause suffering just as surely as direct conflict. And the resulting migration pressure is cited as a critical, immediate signal of that systemic stress.
When law breaks down, conditions become untenable and people move.
In large numbers, seeking stability.
Which means humanitarian neutrality is non-negotiable.
It has to be. The paper stresses that assistance must be insulated entirely from coercive agendas. If humanitarian aid gets tangled up with political objectives or security operations, it loses its neutrality.
And then it loses credibility and access.
Exactly. Insisting on pure neutral aid isn't just a principle, it's a functional necessity to save lives.
Shifting to the path forward, the paper stresses the importance of what it calls the discipline of truth. Why is requiring evidence before force is used so vital for de-escalation?
Because force is final. It's irreversible. And evidence, as the paper defines it, isn't just information. It's information that has been subjected to methods of verification and scrutiny.
So other people can test it.
So independent parties can test its reliability. When a state wants to use coercive measures, the burden of proof has to rise dramatically. If you let accusations substitute for verified evidence, policy just becomes narrative-driven. And narrative simplifies, it polarizes, and it always accelerates escalation.
So independent verification acts as a kind of shared brake.
It creates a shared reference point that doesn't belong exclusively to the powerful actor. If parties agree to submit high-stakes claims to an independent body, they are implicitly accepting that outcomes should be guided by objective facts, not just threat perception.
Which is a warning against threat-based policymaking.
A huge warning. Decisions justified by perceived danger rather than actual proof lead to selective evidence gathering and just incentivize constant escalation.
So what does Dr. Saifali conclude are the two distinct possible futures we are actively choosing between right now?
The first future is normalization. This happens if these exceptional actions succeed without any significant pushback and are just met with international resignation.
In this future, legality is retrospective.
Exactly. Actions are taken, justifications follow later. Order persists, but only through the dominance of the powerful, while the system itself becomes structurally fragile underneath.
And the second, much more difficult path.
Recovery. Recovery requires friction. It begins when the costs, economic, diplomatic, reputational of bypassing the law, start to exceed the short-term benefits of unilateral action. Exceptions have to be actively recontained. And multilateralism must be intentionally used, even though it's slow, because it's the only way to distribute responsibility and establish legitimacy.
And recovery, unlike normalization, is not the default setting. It takes active choice.
That is the key takeaway. Recovery requires enough friction, enough global actors insisting that legality must precede the use of force, not just follow it like an apology. Normalization, on the other hand, only requires international fatigue and silence.
So what is truly at stake here isn't the specific outcome of one crisis. It's the functional integrity of the infrastructure that's supposed to prevent conflict from becoming open warfare. The Caribbean's plea for evidence-first approaches and multilateral engagement. It's not about protecting one side. It's a plea for the discipline needed to ensure that power accepts limits.
And that brings us to the final provocative thought that the paper really forces us to grapple with. The core question for you, the listener, to consider is this. Are we, through our global acceptance and our silence, actively building a world governed by shared restrictive rules?
Or one governed by the cumulative arbitrary sum of unilateral exceptions?
That choice is collective, and it is happening now.